This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 82, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, which is over 20 minutes more, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign, where there are now more than 80 episodes in the back catalogue. For $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Gary Jones about his book, The Denby Lights, A Truthful Argument for the Existence of UFOs. Over the last 7 years, Gary's UFO investigation work has produced some fascinating and hard-hitting evidence that has resulted in solid UFO cases such as the Penturk incident, Denby Lights, Caldicot Triangle, and Landrassant Red Orb, and the mystical lights of Merthyr Tydfil. Gary has had numerous sightings and supernatural experiences throughout his life. Hi Gary, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi Simon, it's great to be here, thank you for having me.
So we're going to be talking about your book, which is called The Denby Lights, A Truthful Argument for the Existence of UFOs. So this is a fascinating case that happened in Wales. It was in Denby, but can you tell us about Denby? Is it just like a small town?
Denby is quite an old town. It's been there for a few centuries. If you were to walk around the place, it is like a small coastal town, you know, with an ancient past. It's got castles there and farmland and small living estates, you know. I mean, I'm not quite sure exactly how many people live in Denby right now, but it's not a big place, but it's an old place. You know, it's got a lot of ancient myths and legends about it, which I discuss in the book, actually, in the first few pages, just to sort of give a flavor to the area that there's a lot more going on about this place than people realize. And I'm always fascinated by the ancient folklore of places. If people are describing strange lights or sounds or apparitions, or, you know, even talks about strange beings, because, you know, there's got to be some truth to it, even though it may have been changed and modified a bit over the centuries. Like, but yeah, I mean, Denby is a small place, but it's, you know, it's a nice quiet area of North Wales.
And did I read it correctly in the book that the RAF do training flights in the area?
The north part of Wales, the coastline area over there, does have on occasion regular flights for mostly from, I think it's from the southern parts of England and Wales, the RAF St. Athens. They send their Hawk aircraft up there. They're like single-seater jets. They do like flying and training and sorties up there once in a while. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that they do a lot of circles around Snowdonia, or Snowdon, the big tall mountain in Wales. Then they come down the coastline between Rhyl and Denby and Llandudno and all that. So yeah, they do regular flights over there on occasion.
I suppose that could be one of the things the skeptics would say about UFO sightings in that part of Wales is, oh, it's the RAF.
Well, as you'll learn as we go forward, I did look into all possible explanations, and I'm sure we'll get to that later on. But it's one of the first things I check, you know. And I mean, it's always possible that the military could be doing something, but it would be very strange for them to do it over a residential area, which is something that you learn about Penturk. They didn't do an exercise there. They actually did come for combat situations. So
there's 9 minutes of video of these lights. And I suppose when the witnesses were watching, that they saw a craft there, but the video only really picked up the lights. Is that right?
Yes, the video was a Cameleo S30 made by Toshiba. Now, for its time, you know, like 2012, it wasn't a bad handheld camera. It would work pretty well in most situations, but at night, you know, it doesn't quite have the range of light settings, ISO range, to see dark things. But with the people's eyes, yeah, the witnesses' eyes, they could see more detail. They could pick up more, what's the word I'm looking for? More darker objects as well. The video just shows the lights. If you do capture a few frames in the video, you can enhance some of the surrounding areas, and it's clear But what you're looking at is some oval saucer-shaped craft. It definitely is a disc oval-shaped craft.
So if we just go over what happened, I think it started with one of the two sons saw the lights and he thought it was a reflection off his TV.
The first person to see it was Nathan Thomas. He was 12 years old at the time. He was up late watching some TV. It was still like the Christmas holidays. And he heard a loud noise outside. It was his bin being blown over. It was one of those, you know, big type council bins with full of rubbish. And there was a storm going on outside. You know, we're talking like 50, 60, 70 mile an hour winds at times, consistently at a 50 odd mile an hour range. Heavy downpour of torrential rain, freezing cold temperatures, poor visibility conditions. You know what the kind of storms we can get here in Britain sometimes. And he went outside to have a look to see what the source of the noise was. And as I said, it was his bin. But as he looked, you know, he could see something flickering through the window or on the window, as he thought at first. And he looked back to think it was a reflection off the TV or mirror or something. And it was. And he opened the window and he could see it was coming from outside in the distance. And realizing he was looking at something truly amazing here, I think, first of all, he went to go get his brother, Alex, who was 14 at that time. And Alex was trying to get asleep and was really tired. And Nathan was knocking on his door, opening it and saying, oh, I think there's something weird out here. Like, I think he was even using the words like, oh, it's a UFO of some sort out there. And Alex was like, oh, go away, Nathan. And, hey, you know, wake me up. But he goes to the window in Nathan's room and the both of them saying, well, you know, Alex's eyes light up big time, and Nathan is really excited too. And then that's when they started to record the first several minutes of footage, which is just those two actually at first. And then later on, we get Linda Pritchard, who is the mother of Nathan and Alex. She was the third one to see it. She was sleeping downstairs. And to cut a long story short, she thought when Alex came down to wake her up that she was like, what? You know, thinking, is it a fire or something? And she goes upstairs, looks out the window, and she too, you can hear it in the video. They're just amazed, shocked, awe. They don't know what they're looking at. And they've lived in this area to that point their whole lives, and they're still living here now, most of them. Never seen nothing like it before or since. And then later on, Keira Lee George, who's Linda Pritchard's granddaughter, she heard the commotion coming through through a bedroom door, and Nathan goes to wake her up. And yeah, at some point, then they're all looking at it. And well, the lights are rotating, flashing, and like anything you see on a normal aircraft. And amazingly, at some point, they go from a horizontal position, so like flat, laying across, you know, level with the ground, and sort of tilting upwards about a 40-degree angle, which is very odd in itself because there's nothing there on the ground or anything that would be used by the military or even those flying drones that would be able to do that or mimic that in any way. So, yeah, the whole thing there for them lasted 15 minutes. And the 9-odd minutes of video footage is real good quality.
And the good thing about it is the audio is, like you're saying, you can hear them talking. And you can genuinely hear the astonishment in their voices. It's like if it was a hoax, they'd have to be pretty good at acting to really put that across like that.
Yeah, that's one of the strong points of the video itself that maybe people pick up on or not. I don't know, because some people are obviously studying the lights. But if you listen to how they respond to each other, how they're talking to each other, and yeah, the tone of voices, you know, you can sense that Alex, I think it was Alex who probably thought that someone was going to come to the door in the following days, you know, to make, like, what did you see? Like, you know, a sort of Men in Black scenario or, you know, like someone from a secret agency or something. And Linda's like, just telling him, don't worry about it. It's nothing like that's going to happen. And Nathan, of course, is quite excited. He wants to put it up on YouTube and all that. So, you know, it's a mixed bag of emotions from them all. And yeah, I mean, what can I say? All of them just are like what is that? What is that? And I have to say, Alex's response at the end when the lights actually go out. And I mean, they go out like someone flicking off a switch, you know, like on a wall. He's like, oh, don't stop. And that's actually what he says. He actually says it like, oh, don't stop. Because obviously they knew they were looking at something truly incredible. And I mean, Nathan got excited at one point because you can see, he said, oh, it's tilting. You can see the top of it, Alex. You can see the top of it. You know, so obviously their eyes are picking up more than what the camera shows. And yeah, that's a good observation for people to make. You know, I mean, how are they reacting? They would have to be great actors and great at forging videos. So, you know, that's two key points we can say there, innit? Either they're masters of forgery and acting, or they've got the genuine thing here. So I go with the genuine thing, of course.
So have you been able to work out how big that object was? Because I suppose you can't really tell how far away it is from the video.
I have actually looked into that. I did a video documentary in, you know, I interviewed them in November of 2018. May have been 2019 or just around the time of 2020. I can't quite remember, but it's on my Rumble channel anyway. And, you know, I asked all of them, I said, do you have any idea of size? You know, could you give me an estimate? Linda was quite certain that it was coming from behind the houses near a field called Kai Howell, which is behind the houses in the distance. You can see it in the video, yeah? She thought it was just beyond that and maybe just up by a school area there, which is in viewing line of the lights themselves. And I just thought, well, you know, you may not be able to give me an exact, you know, the accurate size, but can you give me an estimate? And, you know, we got sizes ranging from 50 to maybe 70 odd feet. So I just decided to use Google Earth, use their position from where they saw it on a, you know, the Google Earth image software. And I thought, well, okay, let's just try and figure out where the furthest side of the right lights are coming from and the furthest left side of the lights are coming from. And I just placed markers, lines in between both of those points and stretched it out as far as the Christmower Woods area. And when I got to a distance of from right, left side to right side of the lights, 70 odd feet, it was more or less in line with where Linda was basically saying it was. Maybe a little further on, just up by the field area, the farmland area. But yeah, you know, I would say this thing had to have been at least maybe 60, 70 feet. So sizable craft.
And it happened at about 3 o'clock in the morning, didn't it? So I suppose there wouldn't be any other witnesses around.
Maybe there are witnesses. I've never met any. What I'm learning with many UFO sightings that I do now, especially with the Panturk thing, people saw stuff, but it's only now they're coming forward, you know, because someone's talking about it and someone's, you know, we've been able to put the evidence forward for Panturk. And now, of course, I've got the evidence in the book for the Denby Lights. So I would imagine at some point I may get more witnesses. But no, at 3 a.m., you know, you're not gonna get many people up unless, of course, they're late night owls or something, you know. It was only just really by chance that the bin blew over that they saw it, really, because if that bin hadn't blown over, they would have never noticed it either.
And 3 a.m., like you say, it was pouring with rain. There could be 50-mile-an-hour winds. Who's going to be outside at 3 a.m.? Mm. And also that counts towards this thing that there could have been people up on a hill with lights or something, but what were they doing at 3 a.m. in a storm with all those lights?
Exactly. That's one of the things that I looked into. I mean, there's a golf course in line with those lights, but when you actually overlay a daytime image on the nighttime one, it's in between a golf course and a farm and some trees. And if someone's going in, someone's up there using lights, they're going around in circles, you know, through trees, dense forest, and some pretty hilly, hard to walk terrain at night. You know what I mean? And somehow they're able to go vertical off the ground as well. Do you know what I mean? Because obviously, you know, that wouldn't happen if someone was just walking on the floor. I mean, I thought maybe it was the quarry because there's a quarry over to the right. But again, that was not in line with it. And I thought, Ramblers, military training, but that's a farm. They wouldn't be on there. I thought maybe Lampers, you know, someone doing illegal hunting, maybe. No, none of these things made any sense. And to be honest with you, I don't think anyone's going to be mistaken by people walking around at night with headlamps on or torches. You know what I mean? Because those things give off, you know, beams and, you know, create bright spots on the ground for, you know, part of the spotlights they create, the torches, isn't it? This is not what's happening here. You know, not at all. So, no, I'm, again, you know, it's 50, 60 mile an hour winds on average because there was a storm going through the northern parts and the middle parts of Britain for the most part that night. The Denby area experienced winds. Yeah, like I said, it's in the book. It's about 55, 60 miles an hour. Gusts as high as 70. Who's going to want to be out in rain coming on your face, freezing cold temperatures at night? Nah, there's nothing to do up there anyway. You know, there's no people with fireworks or sparklers. I mean, what kind of person would be doing that? just silly.
And people can see the video online, can't they? And they can see your documentary on Rumble free of charge. They don't have to pay
for
that.
Yes, yes. I don't charge for things like that. Of course, you know, when it comes to the book, I do have to charge because, you know, it's a publishing deal and, you know, they gotta make their money. So, you know, but I'm just happy to say that a paperback is what, £12? You can get a hardback for 18. You can get it on audio CD if you fancy, Kindle. I think, you know, they're reasonably priced at around £5 a piece. So, you know, I just, otherwise, you know, most of the stuff I do is always available free. So when it comes to books, of course, because they cost money.
And so with the lights, like you were saying, you know, if you have those big LED things on your forehead or just a normal torch, that's going to put a beam of light out and light up the area around it. Mm. But these lights on this craft didn't seem to do that. It's almost like they were pointing directly at the camera and not illuminating anything else.
Yeah, I think there's a word for this. I might not get this right, but I think someone's described it as an incandescent light. I mean, you have a light source from the bulb, but it doesn't really illuminate anything around it. It just shows the light inside the source of the bulb. But yeah, you are correct. The lights, when they shine or when they flash or whatever they're doing, no, they don't illuminate the area around them. They don't seem to show any beams of light coming off of them. And the way they move and flash and, you know, brighten up and dim down, it's unlike anything. I've seen something similar when I was 7, but these are different. Kira, when I asked her about the light, she gave me a good description of it. It's like when you see lights under a swimming pool, you see the water shimmering on the top of it.
Yeah.
You know, it creates that sort of like streaking, shimmering effect. She described it like that, you know, and I think Alex and Nathan were describing it like a contained explosion or a firework with inside itself, which is just really, really odd. No, these lights are unlike anything I've not seen on normal aircraft or lights that people would be carrying around with them, because they obviously, if you need a torch to get around at night, these lights that were on this object would not be sufficient.
So who is Peter Glynn? Who was the original investigator?
Peter Glynn at the time was into paranormal, supernatural and UFO events. He was like a local researcher who liked to do his own stuff. And I think he may have published some work online as well. You know, he's an author, a researcher, and he's got some political background as well. The family at the time didn't know who to contact or who may be able to help them, but I think they were aware of Peter, and they decided to ask him for some help, and he gladly agreed, and he came and interviewed the family, looked at the site from where, you know, the original sighting had been made, did day and nighttime comparisons. He went up to the farm fields as well, and looked around for any signs of human activity, like vehicles or somebody, you know, stomping around, creating like, you know, damp mud holes, you know, with, you know, lots of human foot activity. Anything that may or may not have helped him determine what exactly was happening. But yeah, he did a lot of work. He did a lot of good preliminary work, I thought, on it. You know, he covered a lot of areas, got a lot of good information. And sometime later, I saw his work. When I saw the family, I thought, you know, this is good. I think I know a couple of ways I can expand on all this and really, you know, make it really, you know, just a solid, you know, solid thing. I saw a lot of areas I could expand upon, and other things we could try, like video analysis and stuff, and comparisons and look at radar and things. And you know, it's good for people to get that information quickly, not long after an event, because you can lose a lot of ground if you don't. You know, a lot of things can go and disappear to, you know, to the ages. Like, you'll never retrieve that information.
And you had the video analysis done by Jason Gleaves, didn't you?
Yeah. Jason Gleaves is a former RAF man. And he's now into author of his own books as well. His main area is analyzing and doing detailed analysis, I should say, using various software and imaging techniques that he applies to discover whether or not photos or videos or something could actually be, you know, something of a UFO nature, or whether it's something of a supernatural, strange phenomenon, or, you know, whether it's just something that can be explained, you know, like a strange reflection or something. And I asked him, you know, because I know Jason would gladly help me out here, because he is good in that regard, I must admit. He's very helpful to this cause, you know, of analysis, you know, because it's always nice to have someone do a proper in-depth thing on it, someone who knows what to look for as well. And he concluded, after a video that he put together himself, that this thing was unexplained. It was an unidentified flying object, of course. It's not a drone or any other vehicle you could be aware of, or any other natural known explanation. So, you know, he just confirmed what I already knew, but it was nice to have someone who could apply different filters and different, you know, their own techniques to sort of show me, you know, why this is a genuine video. It's always good to have that.
I thought it was useful that we were able to overlay that daytime image, so you could really see where the craft was.
Yes, that actually placed it more or less where many of others have also thought where it was. And it seems that it's just slightly over the embankment of, in daytime light, it's just slightly over the embankment of the top hill in the woods and in line with the woods area. But obviously the craft is not coming from up the woods. It's a lot closer. And But what I was just going to say is it's a lot closer, and no doubt it's a mechanical object of some kind, which I am certain of.
So they got no interest from the media, though, did they? TV companies, newspapers just didn't seem interested.
Well, I think at first the local press printed something on it. I think there may have been a TV company that did something, I think in America, that had a, I don't know, was it Weird or Wonderful or Weird or True or something, but it was fact or non-fact kind of shows, you know, where they show you things and, you know, give you their own little spin on the story. But they had already finished filming in the UK and, of course, were interested in this, but obviously didn't have time to get back and follow it up, so there was never anything from them. No, the mainstream media never really showed that much interest. And I was amazed to discover that someone had this amount of footage, had this incredible footage. And despite Peter Glynn's efforts and, you know, a famous musician named Skrillex, who had actually found that video and promoted it on his Facebook page, which got Peter's views to go up. And that probably gave it the most exposure that it had at the time. But no, no media company, no newspaper, no journalist came out to interview them. I know the police were contacted at some point, and they just said it was Lampers. Well, if that was their determination of it being Lampers, and I think if I understand it correctly, lamping is illegal in the UK. So why didn't they follow that up with any kind of investigation? You know, criminal charges, criminal proceedings, but No, there's only really been a few odd stories printed here and there. Once Jason did his analysis, there was a little segment in the, I think it was the Mirror, was it the Daily Star, even one of those papers. But it was just like, you know, a little posting of a story. You know, it wasn't really all that in depth. It just said local expert finds foot UFO video genuine. And that was it, really.
So there's this idea that sometimes the UFO, when it's being watched, it knows it's being watched.
Yes, that does sometimes seem to be the case. I've had my own UFO sightings, and usually most of the time they happen by accident. You know what I mean? I'm not looking for them, and I'm not trying to look in. But now that I am sort of paying attention, it's kind of strange how things like that change. And I could give you an example. I think it was April 2017, I believe. I was taking pictures of what I thought were white orbs in the sky, right? Because I was getting a lot of reports from my area, especially for that time of year, that there were a lot of people witnessing strange white objects in the sky at night and in the early hours of the morning. And I thought, you know, that's quite localized, and it's becoming too coincidental to, you know, to be, it's becoming too often to be a coincidence. There's clearly something happening here. So I went outside and started having a look at night midday, just to see if I could find something. And I got this impression to say, point the camera here and take a look. Couldn't see nothing with my eyes. When I took a picture, there it was, this spherical Pokemon ball design-like object that was casting a shadow on the clouds. And at the same time, you know, you can clearly see it had some sort of transparent material and some sort of white outline amongst it. It was very symmetrical in everything it did. And I've had quite a lot of people say that this has happened. You know, they're taking pictures and something says, point the camera over there, and then they see something. Or when people go looking for UFOs, it's like they may suddenly spot it, and then all of a sudden it disappears. So I was amazed that this one didn't quite disappear from the family, especially when it was being observed for a good couple of minutes at least. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like it wants to be seen.
I do have an idea about this. I mean, it's just an idea because, I mean, this is a good thing to bring up here now. In the book, I talk about the Christ Woods or Christmas Woods. It's according to an email I got from one of the Denbighshire council people. That's an ancient woodland. And when I looked up protected sites on Wales, you know, the Christmas Woods was actually on it. And not long after this UFO sighting occurred, and this is something that I got from Margaret Pritchard, who's the sister of Linda, and of course, auntie to Nathan and Alex. She said to me that this whole area had been chopped down just about 4, 5, 6 weeks after this whole thing happened. I mean, I went up to the woods just to have a look around. I didn't know this until I got there, and she said that to me. She said, hang on now, wait a minute. You're telling me that this area was chopped, you know, this place you said was beautiful, picturesque, you know, a lovely landscape, a lovely thing to walk around, you know, with your dog or your family, just to get out for the house, even just for an hour, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden they chopped it all down. Oh, they chopped a good section of it down, I should say. And I often wondered, is that got something to do with this UFO sighting? Because it's becoming abundantly clear to me that whenever some craft gets near a woodland, for some reason, those trees are chopped down. Sometimes they're chopped down within a matter of days or weeks, but no more than a couple of months, maybe. But eventually, they're always chopped down. And the reason usually given for them is, oh, because of some parasite, you know, like Lash disease or, you know, something like that. But when you actually go looking at how these things are conducted, you know, a real sanitized felling, me and Kaz Clark have mentioned this in the Pentark incident a couple of times. It's nothing of the sort. It's like someone just comes in there, chops a lot of trees down, and, you know, it's like they're clearing the area of something. It doesn't make any sense. And that, to me, I'm just wondering if this craft maybe got into some trouble with those trees, and maybe the reason it was being seen for a long time, maybe it sustained some damage. Maybe the storm crippled it for a little while. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
It's just an idea, but I mean, as you say correctly, when these things don't want to be seen, they know they're being watched, they don't want to be seen, but yet here's one being stayed after a good 15 minutes, and yet for a good 9 minutes of video, it's just, it's being observed, which is, to me, kind of strange.
I saw a UFO over the New Forest. I shouldn't publicize it, but we don't want them chopping down the New Forest. That was fascinating, and that was just a big ball of orange light about the size of a car above a tree, and it was about half a mile away from me. It didn't move an inch the whole time, and there was no sound at all. And I did go back to that tree a few days later just to have a look round, just in case, I don't know, maybe there'd been somebody there with some big setup, you know, with a big light on top or something, but in the New Forest, you're not allowed to do that, are you? It's a protected area.
As far as I know, no, you're not allowed to do stuff like that. Not without some sort of permission, anyway.
Yeah.
Anything of that nature, you know, you're using electronics or setting or rigging up some kind of equipment.
You put in the title of the book, A Truthful Argument for the Existence of UFOs. Why did you say that?
Yeah, this is something I always like to do with, you know, with any kind of UFO case. I mean, you give it a name because, you know, people identify with names and titles. But obviously, when you're writing a book, you got to come up with some kind of subheading. When it comes to the Penturk incident, of course, we call it the greatest UFO cover-up of modern times because of everything that's been involved with that. You know, the military and governments and media silence and all the authorities who have been basically lying to us, and we've uncovered a lot of their lies now. And given the scale of the case of the Penturk incident, you know, the greatest cover-up of modern times, you know, I mean, a lot of people are comparing this, the Penturk, to Rendlesham Forest, you know, one of those incredible UFO cases. But what I liked about Denby Lights, I mean, it was like such an open and shut case. It didn't really need to be sold to anyone. As long as someone was willing to take a look, by the time you're finished, you know that's a UFO. You know what I mean? And I just thought, I'm not here to prove the existence of UFOs. I think that's been established for a long, long time. But if anyone's looking for something, a case, where you know, there's no questions asked, you can see the evidence speaks for itself, you know, and it's done in an honest and intellectually honest way. I say, you know, that this one here, you know, if people are looking for, okay, show me a case that actually proves UFOs are real, and, you know, something that'll put my doubts to rest. And I would say, take a look at the Denby Lights. I mean, it's all there. You've got video analysis, a lot of in-depth investigations, witness testimonies, and a lot of other things, which will undoubtedly prove to you that, you know, these things are real. And this is why I call it a truthful argument for the existence of UFOs. So if any doubters out there, even though at this stage of the game, we've had confirmation from the Pentagon with that, the 144 UAPs, they only identified one of them. And 143 they can't identify. And we've had a lot of interesting hearings lately and media stories with the Tic Tac and UFO in particular. I mean, that's all been taken care of now. They've admitted UFOs are real. But of course, you've got skeptics out there who still just won't have it. So I'm just like, that's why I say the Denby Lights, A Truthful Argument for the Existence of UFOs. That's the story. That's a good book for anyone to pick up and say, you know, yep, that's 100, you know, if it only takes one, that's your case right there. It's an open and shut case for me, as far as I'm concerned.
So can we talk about the Penturk incident? Because that is really quite substantial. And when I was finding out about it, I didn't know that so much stuff went on. It's not like it's been talked about. Like you say, the Rendlesham Forest has been gone over and over and over, almost as much as Roswell. But Penturk is unknown to me, I'm afraid.
I have noticed that there's been a lot of shadow banning and censoring and unlisting of links from certain major social media and video sharing companies. I think we all know the ones we're talking about. I mean, even people who live in the area of Penturk have no idea yet that this happened. Do you know what I mean? And the media hasn't said one story about it. There's been hardly any TV coverage. No one really has, who's got any kind of international means of exposing it, like, I don't know, Luis Elizondo or someone, has really come to us and say, okay, let's take a look at this. But when we actually go through the details of the case, people can, and I'm not saying this for myself, but there are people who know this case and all these other big cases. They put it up there with the Roswells and the Rendlesham Forests. Okay? They put it right up there with that. And I've had so many people tell me that. So I think, you know, the consensus on that is pretty solid now.
Was it that there was one of those NATO aircraft circling, and it's one of those ones with the big dome on top, the kind of radar thing?
Yeah, this is... you know, it took me so long to establish a timeline of events, but once I got it all down, you know, it was quite easy. It was quite astonishing to see how this thing unfolded. All the things Cass, Clark, and David had told us about what they'd seen and saw before, during, and after, timeline of events and evidence we put together just confirmed it so much. But, I mean, 3 days prior to the 26th of February 2016, there had been two sort of like spy watcher planes. One was called Jackal, the other one was called Snake. The tail number on this one, Snake 48, was ZZ-418, and that's a Beach Star aircraft, I believe. And it's part of an ISTAR program, ISTAR. I think it stands for Intelligence, Surveillance, Targeting and Acquisitions Reconnaissance. And that works in tandem with the E-3 Sentry plane you just mentioned, with the big radar dome. Now, the two planes I mentioned, ZZ-418 and ZG-996, the one called Jackal, they were taken in turns for 3 days, you know, and in turns, you know, they fly, one would fly in a circle for a couple of hours, another one would do, like, figure eights or crisscross patterns. And this went on for 3 days and nights, and the locals all there were, what is going on here? These planes were sometimes coming as low as, like, 400 feet, maybe even lower than that, and slowing down to such a speed that I'm surprised the planes didn't stall. You know, going as slow as 80 to 100 knots, doing this for days on end. And one night, Kaz and David and a few others decided to do a skywatch, because by now they'd confirmed that the MOD and the local media didn't seem to know anything about these planes. So they just went out in their backyard, watched for a few hours. Time was getting late. Donna was there. She decided to go in and make hot chocolates because she was getting cold and a bit tired. Kaz and David stayed a little longer. They were getting a bit cold as well, even though they had a fire pit lit. And just as sort of Kaz was getting a bit, fed up with it all, a very loud engine noise came from above them. And as they looked, David, who recognized it instantly, could see that this thing was an E3 Sentry. One of those big Renome things, belonging to NATO, as a matter of fact. NATO plane, of all things. And that thing circled the fields along with the other planes. And at some point later, a couple of others joined in. And eventually, whatever it was they were waiting for showed up. Kaz and David saw these red lights appear in the farmland behind their home, and the two of them instantly rushed from the place where they were observing in the garden to the gates, the fields where this craft appeared. By the time they got there, this thing had lit, you know, this thing was starting to light up. You know, it went from like three lights to six lights on each side, and when it was fully illuminated, you could see it was like a large, well, this is their descriptions anyway, a large triangular pyramid-shaped kind of craft. Just phenomenally huge. I mean, it was like many hundreds of feet wide and many hundreds of feet high. I think Kaz said it came down at a sort of a anti-clockwise angle or peak angle. I can't quite remember. But it was turning anti-clockwise at the same time as it came down, like a pendulum swing. Do you know what I mean? It sort of came down like a pendulum would swing, but at the same time, it was turning anti-clockwise. And then it moved across the fields. And I think Kaz was on the gate watching. She said, oh, it's landing, it's landing. This thing almost touched the ground. It let off a big hand of lightning from the corner of the craft. And the energy was dissipated in a place we call the ball patch. And yeah, along as this was all going on, many other small craft appeared. The first one was like a, well, I describe it like a reconnaissance one. It came out of the top of this pyramid thing, like a cannonball being shot out of a cannon, and then it just stopped instantly. And that seemed to act like a scout. I mean, like a reconnaissance vehicle, I describe it. And then David, Kaz didn't see this part, but David said he saw 15 to 20 more of these craft coming out of the top as Kaz was so fixated on the hand of lightning part or it landing on the bottom. And as they said, it was so big, if you looked at the bottom, you couldn't see the top of it. You know, so one was getting more detail than the other when they were observing this thing. And after a while, four military planes, I think one was, they were Hercules planes and C-130 planes, came alongside each other, flew into the area where this pyramid craft was, and the green object that was acting like a reconnaissance thing kind of flashed three green bright strobe lights at it, the planes, and sort of got their got planes' attention and led it to the northwest, away from the Penturk fields into the Smilok Woods area, around Lantrisant. And while that was going on, they looked back to see that the main lights on the large body of the craft had dimmed down. Meanwhile, those barrel-shaped orbs I told you about, the 15 to 20 of them, two of them came across the fields right to the gates where Kaz and David were standing. One took a position about, I think, let's just call it 40 yards from the gates, along a line of gorse bushes, like a hedge, but hedges there. Another one came into the tree just above where Kaz was standing on the gate. It was literally in arm's reach of her. And she described, you know, looking at the inside, it was like the white noise on a TV screen, but it was swirling around. I mean, you'd have to listen to Kaz's description. She tells it very well. This thing went from red to green as Kaz had waved at it, didn't know what else to do, and it shone a green spotlight on the two of them. And Kaz has said sometime now, sometimes she's been saying this, that she heard a voice in her head tell her, you know, tell the world what you saw. At the same time, she felt like all the fear had been taken out of her body, you know, because obviously it was quite an adrenaline-packed night for them both. Exciting, but at the same time, quite nerve-wracking. But at that time, Kaz just felt elated, you know, like she had had all the fear taken out of her. And yeah, the two barrel-shaped orbs went off on their way. One went up over the mountain of Garth Mountain. Another one went to the left, down to the RAF St. Athens area. And sometime later, Kaz and David said they saw three Apache helicopters moving over, because they live on a mountain, and they could see down into the lower areas, especially on the one side of the mountain they were standing on. And these three Apaches went over to the northwest area where that green barrel-shaped object had been going. And about an hour or so later, just maybe an hour, there was this incredible explosion that was felt all around the Smilog Woods, Lantrisan area. There's a place there called the Royal Glamorgan Hospital. And people who worked in the hospital felt the building shake, the doors rattled, the ceilings rattled. Smoke filled the room, do you believe it? Very quickly after that, the roads were blocked off. No one could get home or anywhere around the Smilog Lantrisan Woods area. And there was a lot of activity around that area for some time. And we've just recently had a few witnesses now who've really come forward. Two have gone public. Another one spoke to us, but agreed to let us use what he said as long as we muffled his voice. Okay, well, let's get to the new witnesses. I'll start with a person named Jacob Coleman. We interviewed him at his home, and what he said he saw was one of these green objects, very unusual, bright green object, and it was in some kind of standoff. This is the Smilog Woods area now, where all that explosion stuff took place. And there were two Apaches, so like in a standoff with it. Like one took a position and then another one took a position just behind it, you know, like a backup kind of wingman type of thing. And the green object sort of like stayed where it was, and you know, nothing, none of them moved. And, you know, it was just, it's like it was in some kind of standoff position. We've got his interview. We put it up on our Penturk incident YouTube page. Fascinating reading. Should look at it. And we got Jacob Coleman, who said he saw, sorry, not Jacob Coleman, Mark Morris, I apologize. He said he saw two red and two green objects. And I think he saw them on the other side of the woods, sort of more towards the opposite end, or at least a good distance away from where Mark was watching, Jacob Coleman was watching his thing. And if I could describe it, you know, it's like they were shining beams. Now, this is Mark Morris. These two red, two green orbs were shining like beams of light or spots of light from inside of itself. And they were moving like, it's hard to describe if you can't see me on screen, but if you imagine like the shape of a rainbow.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of moving up and down and moving, not, how can I describe this? You know your wipers on a car?
Yeah.
Right? If you imagine the two of them are going in those, you know, they're wiping across the window and swiping off the rain. If you imagine one is coming, you know, from left to right, and the other one's the opposite angle of that, and the two of them are coming into the middle and going outwards.
Yeah.
We're sort of making that kind of movement. And I thought, that's a bit odd. You know, for them to do that. I mean, that kind of, I've heard that kind of thing before, where it's like one of their objects, or one of their, it's like these 15 to 20 things that came out of that large pyramid seem to be signaling in the others where this thing has gone down. You know what I mean? Like a beacon, if you will. And that other green one seems to be keeping the two Apaches occupied, whilst I guess they're trying to maybe rescue their fallen orb. How I know that something crashed in Smilog Woods, you know, which I know is a UFO crash site now. Kaz and her friends went up to Smilog Woods following the sunrise of that day, and they went up the day after, this time with cameras and more ability to record and document what they found. They found a whole bunch of fresh nap trees and a portion of the woods, which is not far from a bike trail up there. And you could see the trees were snapped and burnt and scorched, freshly done, by the way, because they weren't like discolored or, you know, like they've just faded over time. These were really fresh marks. And this witness that we've got now, I have put his portion of the interview on the Penturk incident YouTube page. I've had to muffle his voice, but I've subtitled the words so you can see what he's saying. Because he doesn't want to be identified right now. And if they don't want to be identified, I have to respect that. But he's been kind enough to let us do this. He said he and a friend were camping in the woods that night. They like to be outdoors. They've got a thing about doing survival training, and you know, that's what they like doing. And some people say that's unusual, but no, not really in Wales. That's an every year round thing. Lots of people are camping in the freezing winter, freezing winter times, and the more colder autumn times, they just find it a bit more refreshing and embracing, I guess. You know, it's just what they do. A lot of people do it. Anyway, they were in some area of the woods camping. They heard some rumbling sound. Then they heard what sounded like an explosion or a big boom of some kind. Deciding to go and take a look at what it was. They entered an area where the crash site was. Remember the one I said just mentioned?
Yeah.
They could see military people were there. And there were three people wearing these white overall suits, like hazmat suits. Now, they hid in some trees on the opposite side of the road, and they were able to sort of observe their behavior. And the one guy described it as something had come down, had broken some trees, and got tangled or buried in some bramble or bushes or you know, lower plant life there. And he did a diagram of it. And what he said was he could see what looked like some sort of object. If you imagine the old Coca-Cola glass bottle.
Yeah.
You cut the top part off of that, you know, the thin bit where you drink out of, and you get that sort of like, you know, that sort of like barrel shape, or that sort of like egg timer shape sort of look to it. And yeah, that's kind of the shape that he described. Now, when he and his friend broke cover, they thought, oh, well, you know, they're just recovering one of their things. They were instantly grabbed, thrown in the back of a truck. Quite intimidating behavior towards them. I mean, look, you thought that these military men were going to really do something to them. They took their phones, did something to them that wiped a lot of the memory off of it. And the original programming of the phone itself. Then they were driven away from the area. And they were told to never go back. I mean, it was quite an intimidating thing for them. Now, this was an exercise, a genuine exercise, right? Which it wasn't. I'll get to that in a minute. You would have every right to be there. Because although the military are training over, you could say, over a public area, which they weren't, but if they were, and Kaz Clark did some really excellent work on this, she went into all the rules, regulations, and laws that govern low-flying training aerial exercises over a residential area. And just about everyone that we looked at, everyone that was uncovered, was either broken, violated, or not followed. And for a long, long time, the media have been saying that this was nothing but a military exercise. Well, after a number of different FOIs, Freedom of Information requests, the latest one that we did was sent off to the MOD and the RAF. And this one went from this reply comes from the Defense Secretariat themselves. So, you know, this comes like directly from the horse's mouth. I asked them, did you do any low flying training aerial exercises for the area of South Wales on February 2016? Their reply was an indefinite no. There were no low flying training exercises. There was no low flying aerial exercises of any kind for South Wales during that time. Considering the fact that the mainstream media, Wales Online in particular, said this was an operation called Exercise Chameleon. Now, Chameleon is a biannular event. It happens twice a year in Britain, but typically it happens up in North England and on the coastal areas of southern Scotland. Never really comes down to South Wales at all, especially not over a residential area. But that was the story they went with for a very long time. And then since we've had that Defense Secretariat confirm to us that that there were no exercises of any kind, you have to then ask the question, if they're violating all their rules, laws, and regulations regarding low-flying training exercises, and they didn't have any exercise in this area, then what were they doing here, Simon?
It was almost like they were expecting them, because they were there days before just circling in those aircraft.
This is where someone like Ross Coulthard, as an Australian independent journalist.
Yeah, he's been a guest on this podcast, yeah.
Yes, I've watched him a number of times. He's very, very good. I mean, he said something about how the aircraft in question, or the military, have a means of detecting their presence or their incoming ability into this planet, usually something to do with electromagnetic interferences. And what's interesting is that much of the area of Penturk and Smilog for a good few years, especially in the areas of interest where things happened, were quite laid with, what's the word I'm looking for? Quite abundant is, I think, the word, with high levels of electromagnetic radiation, especially in the magnetic field range, not electrical field, the magnetic field, for a number of years. I mean, in Smilog Woods by the crash site, there was a signal being recorded there up till 3 years after the event. In Penturk Fields, it was up to 5 years. It remained strongest in the area where the Hand of Lightning came down. And all the other hallmarks are there as well. I mean, people who went into those fields with us during the years of the investigation, the early parts of it, came down with some kind of sickness, you know, like some sort of low frequency radiation, is it? There is electronic low frequencies or something like that. A lot of people have talked about it. But you know, we had sensitive skin, burning of the eyes, nausea, headaches. I felt like someone was burning my skin off when they just brushed with their fingertips among it. And this happened about half a dozen times to me during the very early years when I scanned and filmed that area. That's consistent, again, with elevated levels of electromagnetic radiation, especially in the microwave range. If you look at it on a spectrum, you know, there's a microwave level, you know, range on the EMF spectrum.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, Ross has spoken about this. I mean, I found a report. I can't remember the name of it. I think it was from some defense department in America that also looked at electromagnetic radiation, especially in the microwave level range, which, of course, can have funny effects on people, their health, their nervous system in particular. But especially, you know, when it comes to the weather, it was strange snow in both Penturk and Smilok in the following hours and day just after the event. And we got video of that, actually, from Smilok Woods. And even though for the 26th and 27th and even the 20th and 29th of February, because I think it was a leap year then, was it? Well, the 28th anyway. And I think it was a leap year. It would have been the 29th. But if it wasn't a leap year, it doesn't matter, because for all those days, the 26th, 27th, 28th, there was no snow recorded for weather in Lanchester, or Smilok, or Penturk. And it was just localized to these fields. Now, have you ever heard of anything called angel hair syndrome?
Well, it's been great talking to you. We've just about run out of time.
That's a shame.
We were talking about the Denby Lights, a truthful argument for the existence of UFOs. And you also have that book, which is the Penn, I'm going to say it wrong.
Penn incident.
Yeah, the greatest UFO cover-up of modern times. And if people are looking for that book, we should tell them how Penturk is spelt, shouldn't we?
P-E-N-T-Y-R-C-H.
Yeah, great. It's fascinating information with both of those books. And thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure, Simon.
And that was an interview with Gary Jones about his book, Denby Lights, A Truthful Argument for the Existence of UFOs. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the rest of this interview, which is an extra 20 minutes. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. And there are over 280 episodes. And on the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Past Lives Podcast every Thursday. And that's called Paranormal Stories. And that almost always has UFO information. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. Yes, yeah, I talked about that the other day. There was that's that kind of stuff that I thought it was in the 40s and 50s that people said it would fall off flying saucers at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it was much more abundant and prevalent back then, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the strange weather activities or the strange behavior of the weather, you know, especially to localized areas, especially in areas where both Smilog Woods and Penturk, the only areas that actually had these things happening. You know, you got so many things going on here with the Penturk incident. I mean, another thing I found out recently.